thanks so much. So my name is Elise. I work with an incredibly talented and inspiring group of researchers at the University of Michigan. My bosses are Huda Akil and Stan Watson, not that that really matters in this context. But in general, our lab studies the biology of major depression. So I want to start off by asking a pretty straightforward question. Who in the audience knows somebody who has major depression? Yeah, so that's almost everybody. And I got to say, I'm not surprised at all. The reason I'm not surprised at all is because almost 1 in 5 Americans will experience a depressive episode at some point in their life. And this is a kind of a staggering number if you think about it, right? So that's a full 20% of the population. And I study this disease not only because it's really important, but also because it's really personally significant. I know a lot of people with major depression. Lots of people in my family have major depression. So another reason why it's important to study major depression is because the treatments that we have for major depression really aren't that great. I know that a lot of people are familiar with antidepressant drugs, so SSRIs. Who here has heard of an SSRI? Yeah, so that's a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, and we'll talk a little bit more about them in the future. So outside of SSRIs, there are lots and lots of different types of antidepressant drugs, and you'll probably have also heard of talk therapy. Previous slide, please. Awesome. I'm just going to say slide, if that's okay. Okay. After cycling through several of these drugs, so if somebody gets a diagnosis of major depression, one of the first things a psychiatrist will do is start them on a drug or send them to a therapist, right? That first line of treatment only helps 1 in 3 people. And what's even scarier is after cycling through multiple drugs or cycling through multiple different types of treatment, 1 in 3 people are still never helped. And what this suggests to us is that major depression is a problem that we're not targeting effectively. The treatments that we have are not actually fixing the underlying biological problem. And so it's important that researchers like me and the other people in my lab study this problem so that we can develop a better understanding of the biology and ultimately develop better treatments. This problem is hard. Next slide, please. And it's hard partly because major depression is really, really complicated, and partly because there's no good way of measuring it. So depression is characterized by this wide constellation of symptoms. And I've listed a bunch of them up here on the screen, including depressed mood, loss of interest or pleasure, which clinically is known as anhedonia, or the loss of pleasure, of hedonic pleasure, weight loss, weight gain, sleeping too much, sleeping too little, hypersomnia or insomnia, being suicidal. You get the idea. But all of these are behavioral symptoms. We can't take, at this point in time, a blood sample from people and know whether or not they are feeling depressed and if they're in a depressive episode. And this has really hindered our ability to understand how to diagnose depression and how to treat it. What we do know, next slide, please, is that fundamentally, depression is a problem of the brain. It's not a problem of motivation. It's not a problem of willpower. Fundamentally, it's not a problem here. It's a problem in here. And next slide. And even more, it's critical to understand that depression is a problem of brain circuitry. And what I mean by that is different parts of your brain are really critical for doing different things. So the back of my brain back here is really important for me being able to see. And another part of the brain that I heard a little bit about from my friend Corinne is really important for motor movement. One of the parts of the brain, next slide, that's really important for depression is the hippocampus. So who here has heard of the hippocampus? Yeah. So lots of you have heard of the hippocampus, and you've probably heard about it in the context of memory. So lots of people have heard of the patient HM who died a few years ago and made a lot of news, right? And he effectively couldn't form new memories, partly because his hippocampus had been removed. But another thing that the hippocampus does is it helps to regulate emotions, and it helps to connect the emotional imprints of things that happen to you to your memories. So you can imagine that if something goes wrong with this structure in the brain, it's not really that hard to connect it to the symptoms of major depression, right? Next slide. a little bit more about the hippocampus. So what you're seeing here is a top-down, or like looking in at the bottom or top of my head, picture of a post-mortem human brain. So in this image, the top of the screen would be where my eyes are. The bottom of the screen would be the back of my head. And the right hemisphere has been dissected away to reveal this structure, this curlicue seahorsey, which is actually how the hippocampus got its name, is its seahorse. Seahorsey-like structure, the hippocampus. What's important for you to know about the hippocampus in major depression is that scientists and doctors have actually observed major differences in this structure in people who have depression versus people who don't. And what I mean by that is that in people who have depression, the hippocampus is a lot smaller. And I mean a lot smaller. Then, like, you can put somebody in a brain scanner and actually measure the size of their hippocampus and do statistics and show that it's smaller from somebody who doesn't have depression. And so what could be causing this shrinkage? What could be causing this withering of this critical structure? Well, there are a number of possibilities, but there are two that our lab focuses on, including the survival of the cells in the hippocampus, or the neurons, which are the brain cells, or the connections between these cells, which is really critical for how the hippocampus can function. And what I want to tell you about there is that there are molecules in the brain that I'm going to tell you about at length in just a second called growth factors that regulate both of these functions. So this is a fancy computer simulation of a molecule called a growth factor. And there are actually lots and lots of different kinds of growth factors. I actually only study two. This is one of the ones that I study. The reason why we have a fancy curlicue rainbow goofy looking structure up here on the screen is because there's no way that we can see this even with the highest powered microscope that we have. These things are so tiny. So if you can picture the thickness of a sheet of paper, it's about 100,000 nanometers. One of these is about 10 nanometers. We're talking teeny, teeny, tiny. So this rainbow structure is the best guess that scientists have been able to come up with for what it actually looks like in 3D. Now, growth factor is kind of a weird, complicated, scientific, jargony term, right? It's not really very descriptive. It probably makes you think of a lot of random things. And scientists have this tendency to name things strangely, right? So I'm going to tell you why growth factors are named growth factors. Well, factor is just a general substance that, in science terms, does something. And growth is what describing what it does. So if you were to put this substance, growth factors, in a dish of cells that you can grow in a laboratory, those cells will grow towards the growth factor. And that's how these guys were named. My lab studies a specific family of growth factors called the fibroblast growth factors. And these were mostly named because of the effect that they first had when they were observed to affect skin cells or fibroblasts when they were grown in these conditions. So like I said, growth factors are really important in the hippocampus in particular because they have two functions. One, they affect the connections between the cells, which I'm sort of illustrating with this circuity complicated diagram that isn't actually the connection between those two cells. The other thing is that they impact the survival of the cells in the hippocampus. And if those cells die, you can imagine that the function of the hippocampus is going to die. And what's even more important is that we have seen in the postmortem brains of people who had depression when they were alive that this family of molecules is really, really screwed up. And specifically, I'm going to tell you a little bit more that one of the molecules I worked on goes way down in depression. So you can think about these guys kind of like superheroes, right? So if in general they're helping to do good things like to promote the survival of cells and promote the ability for these cells to talk to each other, then they're kind of acting like superheroes in a city. So you can think about the hippocampus kind of like a city, and you can think about the connections of neurons like bridges or streets. And if something bad happens and you fall into a depressive episode, you can think about damage to a city, like if a terrorist or somebody blows up a bridge. So our superhero growth factor is essentially working to promote the health. Jeez, promote the health of these neurons. Maybe step back. Yeah. Oh, thank you. So growth factors are working in this capacity to help promote the health of the hippocampus or help promote the safety of the city. And in a healthy hippocampus, or in somebody who has never been diagnosed with major depression, you have lots and lots and lots of these molecules floating around. The levels are very, very high in a healthy hippocampus. But when somebody gets depressed and something bad happens to them and they start falling into depressive episodes over and over and over again so that they just really can't pull themselves out of it, this superhero growth factor, the levels in your hippocampus go way, way down. We've seen this in people who were diagnosed with major depression when they were alive because they donated their brains to science so we could understand their disease better as a gift after their deaths. We've also seen it in the lab under more controlled settings. So if you provide stress, then you can also impact the levels of these growth factors in the hippocampus. What's cool, though, is that these growth factors are also responsive to successful treatment. So remember how I said that 1 in 3 people don't respond to treatment successfully? That means that 2 out of 3 people do, which is great. And that means that we have a number of different treatments that can help and that are doing something to the underlying biology. And what we're seeing is that if you can successfully treat major depression, you can partially recover the levels of the growth factor that you lost if you were depressed and weren't being treated. So this is really important, right? So to summarize, what I'm showing you here is a graph for what we think is happening with the superhero growth factor. So on the y-axis, I'm just giving you an indication about how much growth factor there is in the hippocampus, with the bottom being low and the top being high. And on the left, what we think is going on with how much growth factor is happening in depression, or in the health rather, and on the right is in depression. And so we can see this line where if you're healthy, you generally have really high levels of this growth factor, and if you get depressed, then those levels decrease. But the plot thickens. I'd like to say that biology was as simple and as straightforward as give me a shot of growth factor in my hippocampus and my major depression is cured. Yes. Not shots. It's unfortunately not that straightforward. And one of my jobs here at the university is to characterize a growth factor that's in the same family as the superhero growth factor that does the exact opposite thing. So this is my villain growth factor. This growth factor is actually increased in the brains of people who had depression, and it is at low levels in people when they're healthy. And when you provide stress, it increases the expression of this growth factor. You increase the amount of it. And so my job here at the university is not only to characterize this growth factor in major depression and in models of major depression much more extensively, but also to try and understand how it interacts with the hero growth factor and if they're actually doing anything to each other. So if we can add in another line to this guy, what we think is going on is that these guys are essentially working in opposition, where if you have, during health, you have low levels of the villain growth factor, and during depression, you have high levels of the growth factor, and that's in direct contrast of what's going on with the superhero. And so what my job here, again, is to understand how these guys relate to each other and if there's such a thing as an optimal balance. So if what I'm telling you is that during health we have high levels of superhero growth factor and low levels of villain growth factor, then maybe what's happening during depression is that that balance is getting screwy. It's also important to understand that there's almost nothing that goes on in biology, and in particular in the brain, that doesn't have some significance. And so it's not true that, and it's not fair to characterize the villain growth factor as only being a villain. He's probably playing a really important role during health that we just don't understand yet. So it's not also fair to just say, oh, okay, well, you can just completely eliminate the levels of the villain growth factor and you'll be okay and you'll never get depressed. And so that's what makes my job really complicated, but also really, really rewarding. So I just want to end on a happy note because it's, you know, a little tough to end a great event like this talking about depression, right? And I want to come back to this idea of why I study what I study and why I think you should care about growth factors in depression. Well, the first is to develop better biomarkers. And what I mean by that is if you're diagnosing somebody with hypertension, you can take their blood pressure and you can get an idea about what's going on with them and you can put them on effective drugs. But we don't have anything like that with depression. You can only diagnose somebody based on their symptoms. So if we study growth factors, we might be able to understand if they themselves can act as biomarkers. Importantly, I've told you that we have a couple of growth factors that seem to be doing opposite things. And that means that we might be able to develop a drug that acts kind of like a growth factor. What I'm sort of leaving out here is that we have to be really careful with this drug development because growth factors act in actually almost every cell in your body. And there's some of the molecules that can get dysregulated in cancer. So we have to be very, very careful about how we design these drugs so that we're only doing good things and not doing bad things. And the last thing that I want to sort of point out is that there's a lot of hype around this idea of personalized medicine. So everyone sitting here in the room has a very slightly different genome, and all of these differences in your genome contribute to whether or not you're going to be vulnerable to developing depression and other diseases. And so if you have a better idea about what's actually happening in you at a genetic level, then we might be able to determine a better course of treatment. And so ultimately, this research is also sort of geared in that direction. So, I told you a lot about growth factors and major depression. Like I said, my name is Elise. I'm part of the team, including Leah Bricker, who's in the back, and Katie Prater, who's actually unfortunately not here tonight. And we've run real late. And I just want to say that this has been a phenomenally amazing experience for me to watch all of you improve and to work with amazing collaborators. And I really, really, really want to say thank you so much to the Nerd Night bosses, Amber and Mariah. It's been so, so awesome to be able to work with you guys and send our speakers out to do this really important work. So thank you, and I hope you can give them a round of applause.